I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the international community urges a political transition in Syria.
The political solution we all seek is the best way to end the suffering of the people of Syria.
Iran says it's willing to hold nuclear talks before its election. The White House releases Benghazi emails. And two Israeli high school students compete in a $4 million science competition. It's all ahead. In a vote at the UN General Assembly Wednesday, support for Syria's opposition was weaker than previously, with a symbolic resolution garnering less outright support and nearly double the abstentions than a similar vote 9 months ago. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has details.
Reacting to the continued paralysis in the 15-nation UN Security Council, Qatar and several other countries decided several weeks ago to push for a resolution in the UN General Assembly on the situation in Syria, which continues to deteriorate. In the meantime, the United States and Russia put forward an initiative aimed at getting representatives of both the Syrian government and opposition to the negotiating table next month. Despite the objections of Russia, Syria, and several other countries that General Assembly action now would be counterproductive, the draft resolution was approved Wednesday with a vote of 107 in favor, 12 against, and 59 abstentions. The non-binding resolution welcomes the establishment of the opposition Syrian National Coalition as effective representative interlocutors needed for a political transition. It also calls for an inclusive Syrian-led political transition through dialogue with representatives from both the government and opposition. The United States, one of nearly 60 co-sponsors of the resolution, disagreed that it would hurt efforts to bring the Syrian sides together. Deputy U.S. Ambassador Rosemary DiCarlo spoke in the General Assembly before the vote.
In our view, the resolution before you is consistent with this latest initiative. Adopting this resolution will send a clear message that the political solution we all seek is the best way to end the suffering of the people of Syria.
Most of the no votes were expected. Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and Venezuela were among them. But nearly twice as many countries abstained compared to last August, when the General Assembly overwhelmingly adopted another resolution on Syria. This time, 26 fewer countries supported the measure with a yes vote. Some diplomats suggested this reflected growing concerns about Syria's divided opposition and extremist elements among it. More than 70,000 people have been killed in the more than 2 years of Syria's conflict, while nearly 6 million more have been either displaced or fled to neighboring countries, causing a severe humanitarian crisis in the region. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Iran's top nuclear negotiator says Tehran is ready to continue nuclear talks with world powers at any time to address their concerns about its controversial atomic program. Saeed Jalili said today that Iran is willing to meet negotiators from the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council plus Germany before or after its June presidential election, in which he is a candidate. He also reiterated Iran's position that it has the right to enrich uranium. The world powers, known as the P5 plus 1, are pushing for Iran to stop some of its enrichment activity. They're concerned this could be used to make weapons, but Iran says its nuclear program is peaceful. Jalili was speaking in Istanbul a day after meeting EU foreign policy chief Catherine Ashton to discuss the possibility of holding another round of negotiations. Also, a senior United Nations official said talks between the UN nuclear watchdog and Iran about Tehran's nuclear program failed to reach an agreement. The International Atomic Energy Agency's top nuclear inspector, Herman Nackertz, spoke with reporters Wednesday.
We had intensive discussions today, but could not finalize the structured approach document that has been on the negotiation for a year and a half now. So our commitment to continued dialogue is unwavering. However, we must recognize that our best efforts have not been successful so far. So we will continue to try and complete this process.
The Iranian negotiator, Ali Ashgar Sultanay, also spoke with reporters.
Proposals were given by both sides. We have decided that both sides would work out carefully on these proposals given today. And then the next meeting we gave the results. But aiming of this whole elaboration is to bridge the gaps towards the conclusion of the text by the next meeting. Therefore, I have to say that we had a very constructive and intensive discussion today, and this will continue.
The IAEA wants to visit facilities to resolve questions about the program. Suspected militants in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula reportedly abducted six security personnel today. Kidnapped include five policemen and one border guard, none of whom were in uniform. The latest kidnappings took place outside the city of El Arish, the capital of North Sinai governorate. Officials said they have identified the kidnappers and suspect they took the security members hostage to demand the release of other militants held in prison. Egypt's state news agency says President Mohamed Morsi has held an emergency meeting with the defense and interior ministers to discuss the kidnapping. VOA correspondent Elizabeth Arad is monitoring the situation from Cairo. My colleague Ashanathi Abaji asked her why the Sinai Peninsula in particular is becoming increasingly lawless.
Well, certainly, as these latest kidnappings indicate, there are more frequency, various violent events. It's not clear exactly what the motivation is for this particular one, whether it is money or for people to press a cause such as getting relatives or friends out of jail, or as an act of militancy. What we've seen in Sinai is microcosm of the general breakdown in security across the country. It's particularly bad there because the local people are very disenfranchised. The tourist dollars that you see along the coast do not make it to the largely Bedouin natives of Sinai. It's also governed by the peace treaty with Israel, and there's a limit to how many Egyptian troops and police forces can be stationed there. So this has all come together in kind of a perfect storm of a vacuum of security in a time of great uncertainty and increased militancy.
Of course, the government has its own explanation. It says Sinai has, in fact, become a breeding ground for what it calls terrorists. Is that allegation backed by the reality on the ground there?
It's hard to always judge what a government says on subjects like terrorism. There may be other agendas, but clearly there is a growing militancy. We have seen various attacks on Egyptian troops by militants. We've seen increased attacks on Israel based out of Sinai. This latest allegation was a terror cell, and they said they got training in Sinai. There's no way to verify that at this point. But certainly just the sheer numbers of attacks, which did, to be fair, started before the revolution. We saw in 2005 bombings of the Sharm el-Sheikh resorts, and there have been previous ones of Taba. It's a very volatile region, and again, not terribly strongly controlled by any military force.
Should the presence of these terrorists in that part of Egypt, the Sinai, should that be more of a concern to the government in Egypt or to Israel, which literally borders the Sinai?
It actually is proving to be quite a challenge to both, and that was best exemplified last August when 16 Egyptian soldiers were killed by militants who then promptly turned around, tried to crash into Israel, but were killed by Israeli forces there. So it's definitely both Egyptian targets and Israeli targets are threatened by these growing militants.
Now, in Sinai itself, how expansive a network are we talking about here? Do the militants, or terrorists as the government calls them, do they have known foreign connections of any sort?
It's not clear their foreign connections, and their numbers are probably not great. What is very important in this area is that it serves as a transit point. So what has happened since the Arab Spring, Libya, which had lost control of its arms, this new government has been unable to rein in all the militias. Many of them have been selling weapons caches from the Gaddafi era. They make their way across Egypt into Sinai, then onto Gaza, and in some cases beyond Gaza to Syria and other places. We're also seeing weapons coming up, the same trade coming up from Sudan. And some people argue that it's Iran providing weapons to get up into Levant and to Gaza and their allies there and other places.
VOA Cairo Bureau Chief Elizabeth Arendt. President Barack Obama moved late Wednesday to head off further potential political damage from the controversy over his administration's response to last year's terrorist attack on a U.S. diplomatic facility in Libya. VOA senior White House correspondent Dan Robinson reports.
The White House released 100 pages of emails detailing intense debate among administration officials and the CIA about how to word public talking points after the attack in Benghazi. Four Americans, including U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens, were killed in the attack. The emails were originally requested by Republican lawmakers investigating the response to the Benghazi attack. Until Wednesday, the White House had declined to make them public, allowing lawmakers only to review them. The decision to release the emails was an effort to calm the furor over the Benghazi issue, which, with other controversies, threatens to slow or damage Mr. Obama's second-term agenda. Republicans accused the administration of mishandling security and the response to the attack. They asserted that mentions of prior terrorist threats, including by groups linked to Al-Qaeda, were removed for political reasons. The emails confirm what had been reported before by media organizations that then State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland asked that a reference to an Al-Qaeda-linked group, Ansar al-Sharia, be removed. In the email, she expresses concern that the content could be used by members of Congress to beat the State Department for not heeding CIA warnings. One former White House official, former National Security Council spokesman Tommy Vietor, referred to massive disinformation at the time in the U.S. Congress. Final talking points eliminated CIA references to Ansar al-Sharia and to CIA warnings about extremist threats linked to Al-Qaeda in Benghazi and eastern Libya. Also eliminated was a reference to indications that Islamic extremists participated in the violent demonstrations in Benghazi. Earlier Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney reiterated President Obama's remark earlier this week that the Republican investigation was a political sideshow.
It is absolutely political. And we have, in the course of this, been focused on what isn't political and what is essential, which is the fact that four Americans were killed, and we need to find those who are responsible and bring them to justice. Secondly, we need to take action to ensure that the inadequate security that clearly existed at the time, because we could not protect those four Americans, be looked at and addressed so that it doesn't happen again.
Release of the emails does not end the Benghazi controversy as Republicans press for additional documents. Republican Representative Daryl Issa welcomed the email release but said there is still much more for Americans to learn about the administration's response to the Benghazi attack. Dan Robinson, VOA News, the White House.
High school students who are also developing scientists are competing for over $4 million in awards at the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair in the U.S. city of Phoenix, Arizona. Among the estimated 1,500 kids are two from Israel, co-working on a system to detect earthquakes before they strike. We got a chance today to speak with 18-year-olds Nicholas Marone and Aviv Rabinovich. Hi.
Hi. Hi.
This is a great opportunity for you all. Let's begin with you, Nicholas. What can you tell us about your project?
Our project is about saving lives. We developed a system that we suppose that can detect earthquakes at least 20 minutes in advance. We do require more checks, but it works.
And how does it work, Nicholas?
It monitors changes in the high atmosphere, and basing on those changes, it can alert of an earthquake.
Well, Aviv, you know this could be very valuable to many people who live in quake-prone areas.
Yes, of course. The reason we chose this subject is because it can save many people's lives. We know it will affect greatly lives of a lot of people.
Yes. How did you get the idea for this system?
We talked with a professor from Tel Aviv University. He gave us the idea. There was a previous research done on the subject, but he talked only about extremely large earthquakes.
So maybe you could give us a little more detail for those of us who are not scientists on how this detects them.
The system monitors using GPS, normal GPS, changes in the ionosphere, which is the high atmosphere over 100 kilometers above. And when the system reads rapid changes in the concentration of free electrons, of electrons that are just wandering around up there, then it detects an earthquake.
Well, Aviv, have you patented your project?
No, we haven't.
Okay, maybe you'll want to think about doing that.
We considered doing that. We're going to look more into it.
Good idea. Has anyone come forward and offered you any money for your project?
Not yet.
But you're waiting, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, do you think you're going to win tomorrow?
We hope.
Yes, we hope so.
Well, if you get a big wad of money, what are you going to use it for?
I'm going to take my girlfriend to a restaurant.
And what about you?
I'm not sure, but I'll do.
Maybe put it into education.
Maybe.
Okay. Well, thanks, you guys, and good luck tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Budding scientists Nicholas Marone and Aviv Rabinovich, 18-year-olds from Israel, speaking with us early today from Phoenix. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yalke in Washington. Thanks for joining us.